What Pastor Ross said about a race segues very well into our message today, where we're going to be talking about winning the great race. And in the Christian life, it's not a sprint, it's more of a marathon. Now, I've told Karen for several years that before I get too old, I've always thought it would be neat to run in a marathon. I've never done that. And she has. She ran at least a partial marathon. I thought I saw you here somewhere. You ran the whole thing. But did you run the whole thing? You finished. That's impressive. Yeah, absolutely. Amen. It's better than I did. But so I've always thought, you know, before I get too old, which could be any day now, I thought it'd be nice to run in the Sacramento Marathon or something. And so I've toyed with that, but that's as far as I got, because if you're going to do it, you got to train. You know where the story of the marathon first comes from? Back in about 490 BC, the king of Persia, Darius, was bringing an army of 25,000 to fight against Athens, and the Athenian general only had 10,000 soldiers, and they needed some help from Sparta. And so they sent a runner by the name of Phidias so that he would go and give a message. He had to go 147 miles, and he was their fastest runner. So Phidippides, I knew I said his name wrong, Phidippides. And if you go to college for 8 years, you can get a degree called Phidippides Kappa. No, I just made that up. Anyway, Phidippides was the fastest runner, and so he ran 147 miles nonstop. That's what you would call today an ultra marathon. He delivered the message, and they said, "You go back and you tell them that we'll be there as soon as the full moon is over," which was just a few days, "and that help is on its way." And so he was so excited to bring this good news, he turned around and he ran 147 miles back, and he encountered them on a field called Marathon, where the Persians were approaching. Well, the Spartans eventually caught up. There was this big battle of Marathon. Phidippides didn't really get any time to rest, and then he was told after they won the battle of Marathon, if he could run 25 miles back to Athens and tell them that they won the victory. And as the story goes, when he finally got to the marketplace of Athens, he shouted out, "Nike, Nike," which is where you get the name for the tennis shoes, which means victory in Greek. And he fell down and died. And he figured that if he didn't, they'd just send him off running somewhere else. And so he was tired. And why they come up with 26.2 miles for a marathon, I've never quite figured out how that fits in with the story, but that's what it is nonetheless. That's a long way to run. Christian life is not a sprint. It's a marathon. And the Bible talks about us running this race, and we need to run that race with faithfulness. You know, in the Bible, when it talks about runners, a lot of times runners were involved in either war or they were involved in bringing messages. And it wasn't uncommon around the world. There were people, they didn't have the internet. The internet was the fastest runners. They did not have television or radio or the Pony Express per se. And so they had foot runners. Even among the Inca Indians in South America, they had thousands of miles of road that these runners would run. And I don't know if any of you have seen some of the roads there. They were not just flat. Some of them were just virtually up and down, and these runners would bring messages from the kings to the other parts of the realm, and they would bring back the response. And sometimes the runners would go down, and they'd bring a message to the ocean, and as a royal treat, they'd bring some seafood up to the king, and you had to run it pretty quick if you wanted it to be somewhat fresh when you got it there. So runners were bringing important messages. You know, the Bible talks about this in Isaiah 52:7. And we're running with a message. "How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace, who brings glad tidings of good things, who proclaims salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. You know, we have been given a message of victory, and the Lord wants us to take that message and to run and to share that good news. Now, some of you may or may not remember a story in the Bible when there was a battle involving King David. It was a battle between the forces of David and the forces of his son who had rebelled, whose name was Absalom. And they were victorious in the battle, but in the course of the battle, Absalom was caught when his mule ran underneath a tree, caught suspended between heaven and earth. Maybe he was looking back and he turned around and the fork of a tree actually caught him by the head. And there he was hanging between heaven and earth. He died there. But the good news was the kingdom, which was caught up in this civil war, would now be restored. They'd gained the victory. And it says here in 2 Samuel 18, verse 19. Don't know if you remember this story. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. Ahimaaz was a priest. His son Zadok was a young man of the royal priesthood who also was very fleet of foot. He said to Joab the general, now let me take the news to the king, how the Lord has avenged him of his enemies. He wanted to bring this message of victory, this message of good news to David, who was in a fortress down by the Jordan River. And Joab said, no, you'll not take the news this day. We'll let you take news another day. His job was not to be a messenger. He was one of the priest's sons. But today you'll take no news because the king's son is dead. That's interesting. He said, you know, this is a bittersweet victory. Yes, they won the war, and yes, the kingdom would now be united once again, but at the same time, David is going to have to hear the news that his son died. Because the last thing David said before the battle, be careful with Absalom. Do what you can to spare my son. Today you'll take no news because the king's son is dead. Then Joab said to the Cushite, Joab had 10 servants, and one of them was an Ethiopian who I guess was pretty fleet of foot. He said, go tell the king what you've seen. Bring him a message about the battle. Well, Ahimaaz was a little bit worried because he knew this was going to be very hard news for the king to bear. And he went back to Joab and he said, after the Cushite bowed himself to Joab and he ran, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, whatever else happens, please let me run also after the Cushite. And Joab said, why will you run, my son, since you have no news ready? There's no other message. But whatever happens, he said, let me run. You ever feel like that way with a message? You want to run? You just want to run. You want to tell someone. You know, you got news, you want to share it. But beyond that, Ahimaaz knew that this was going to be hard for David. And he thought, if I can get there before the Cushite, I can break the news to him easy. I want the king to first focus on you won the battle. Because the first thing David's going to want to know is, what happened to my son? And he was right. So Joab said, all right, run then. And Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain, and he outran the Cushite. He knew a quicker way to get there, and he must have been pretty fast because he outran the official runner. And David had the messengers looking for some word from the battle. Their watchmen were watching from the wall, said, is there any news? And he said, there's someone coming. It's a runner. And he looks like he's bringing news, and said, good, that's message of the war. If he's coming alone, that means that it's victory, because when the army was defeated, all the soldiers kind of ran back together. Said, one coming alone, that's good news. He said, it looks like there's someone else running now. He's coming by the way of the plain. And it said, it looks like Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, because I guess he had a reputation of being so fast that he was outrunning the official messenger. And he said, he's a good man. He also has good news. And then he came to the king, and king said, tell me, what is the news of the battle? And he said, all is well. The kingdom is united. You're on the throne. The kingdom will be saved. And you know what the next thing David asked? What of any news of the young man Absalom, my son? And he knew, but he wanted to break it. He said, I saw there was a tumult, but I couldn't tell exactly what happened. So he was preparing the king, and then just a few minutes later, the Cushite ran up, and David said, we won the victory. He said, we won the victory. He said, how's Absalom? And he said, May all the enemies of my lord the king be as that young man. David knew that meant he died during the battle. Now, that story is something like what our job is. We actually have good news of a victory, and the reason we have good news of a victory is because the Son of David died in the battle. Jesus is the Son of David, and it's his death that really gives us a message of victory, that we are going to be united once again with God. But I threw that in because I thought, you know, here you got a story of one runner trying to outrun another runner. We've got a message of actually very good news, and Jesus has told us to take it to the world. Now, if you're going to win the race of life, and if you're going to win that race of working for the Lord, it takes training. I told Karen I want to run a marathon. I've told her for several years since I was about, I told her I wanted to do it before I was 50. I'm 57 now, just to give you some history about this dream of mine. And she said, you know, Doug, you're going to have to train. And the reason I haven't entered is because I haven't trained. You can't play racquetball and then start running a marathon. It's a different kind of training. And if we're going to run that race of God, you need to prepare. That's why Paul said in the verse we read during our memory verse, but I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I preach to others, I myself should become disqualified. You know, being a Christian requires self-control. It requires discipline. And that's not always easy. It ends up bringing you greater happiness, but if you're going to run the race of life, then you need to pray that God is going to help you be faithful in the little things. And as we continue to train with the Lord on a daily basis, learning to go a little farther and a little farther, being more faithful, gaining bigger victories, praying bigger prayers, overcoming the little temptations, preparing you for overcoming the big temptations, you are preparing to be a winner in that marathon of life. Have you ever heard about Cliff Young? I know some of you here have. Don't spill the beans. I knew exactly who was going to know about him. 1983, this shepherd farmer, potato farmer from the boonies, the bush, suddenly entered one of the biggest races in the world. It's an ultra marathon race between Sydney and Melbourne, 544 miles. And he shows up and he enters this race with 150 world-class athletes, many of them sponsored, who trained for years. And everyone kind of laughed when he showed up because the fellow's 61 years old. He's wearing rubber galoshes over his boots and probably little more than overalls. I mean, he really wasn't wearing your traditional sponsored running gear. And they took off on this race. And he was quickly left behind by the whole pack. And as he ran along, people were laughing and commenting because he did look a little awkward and out of place, a little backward. But what they typically during this race that normally took between 6 or 7 days is the runners would run up to 18 hours a day. Can you imagine that? I can't run for 20 minutes without getting bored. 18 hours that day, then they'd sleep and eat 6 hours, and there was no set schedule, just whoever finished the race first won. And Cliff, when he took off running, they ended up calling it the Cliff Young Shuffle because he didn't even really look like he was running. He wasn't quite walking. It was kind of a lope, a shuffling lope. But he was very consistent about it. And people along the way, it was very hot too. They said, someone needs to help that old guy. The organizers of the race need to stop him before he hurts himself. He's too old. He's going to be out there. He's all left in the back of the pack. But what they didn't know is that his early life as a shepherd, he spent a lot of time running after sheep. Shepherds have to run. I'll get to that in just a minute. And he had sometimes spent days chasing sheep. And so when he finally caught up with the other runners that were already deep asleep, he didn't stop to sleep. But he just kept on running. His mother, who was kind of watching him along the way, she gave him occasional water and a sandwich or something that he ate while he was running. And Cliff just kept on running. So when the runners woke up the next day and they saw Cliff was out ahead, they were shocked. Eventually they started catching up to him. But that night when they got to camp and they stopped to rest, he just kept running. And people said, someone's going to stop him. His heart's going to rupture. Human can't do what he's doing. going 24 hours. There's even an interview you can see online where some news person idling along in their car, and they got the camera, and a reporter comes up to Cliff and puts a microphone in his face, and he's just going along, just taking it easy. And they said, "So you really think you're going to finish this race?" "Yeah, I'm going to finish it." "You think you're going to win?" "Yeah, I'm going to win." They said, "What makes you think you're going to win this race?" "Spent all my life taking care of sheep. We couldn't afford horses. And I used to have to go round up 2,000 sheep. And they sent me out there and I just had to run on foot. And sometimes it took me days of running to round up all the sheep. See, I can run this race." And would you believe it, that first day I think they caught up and they passed them again. But he kept running through the night. And then he got so far out ahead of them, I think he slept 2 hours in the whole race. And he completed it in record time. He broke the record by 9 hours. 61-year-old vegetarian. Teetotaler. He didn't drink alcohol. And they said, "How could you do that? How could you keep going?" He said, "Well, I just kept imagining that I was trying to round up the sheep and I was running from a storm, because those were the other things he used to run from." So he had trained. Isn't that amazing? You know, you ever heard the story about Aesop's fable of the tortoise and the hare? And the thing that gave the tortoise the victory was he plodded along where the hare would sprint and then he'd party and rest, and then he'd sprint a little part and rest. But the tortoise just kept plodding. He kept plodding, and pretty soon he passed up the rabbit while he was sleeping. And that's exactly what Cliff Young did. Do you know what it says in Ecclesiastes 9:11? "I returned and saw under the sun, the race is not to the swift." The race is not always to the swift. You might be thinking, how can I be victorious in this Christian life? "Not many wise, not many noble, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise." You might think, "I don't have any extraordinary abilities. I don't have any supernatural spiritual power. I'm just a mediocre Christian." But can you keep plodding? That's what really makes a difference. Can you keep going? Will you get discouraged, thinking it's a sprint, you wear yourself out, you don't finish the race? In the Christian race, you might have a bad start. Cliff Young got passed by everybody in the race. But then one by one, he came back and passed every one of them that had passed him. You might have a bad start. With a Christian life, the idea is you want to have a good finish. You want to hold on and keep on running. So it takes training. And sometimes it takes years of training. He trained 61 years for that race. You might be thinking, "Lord, am I ever going to experience some sanctification? Are you making progress?" As I told you earlier, it says, "Those who win the prize must be temperate in all things." And it's through keeping our bodies in subjection and temperance and being faithful in the little things, we grow and we learn. I told you also, shepherds know how to run. I just thought this was interesting. Did you ever think about David as a runner? But it says he was. 1 Samuel 17:17, "And Jesse said to David his son, 'Take now for your brothers that are out at the battle an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves and run to the camp of your brethren.'" And David, what do you think, taking care of those sheep, did he know how to run? His father didn't say walk. David got up and he ran. Have you noticed that when David went to battle against Goliath, I'm in chapter 17, verse 48, Goliath went out to meet David, and it says David hurried and ran towards the army to meet the Philistine. You know, soldiers need to know how to run. You can't always be walking. Now, in Bible times, that was especially important because there was a crucial zone of arrow shot, as far as an arrow would go. And you wanted to stay beyond that. But once you got, when two armies finally were committed to engage each other and the front lines of those armies began to approach each other, usually in a valley, once they got within arrow shot, you didn't want to go slow because you were just a sitting duck. Once you committed that you were going to cross that line where their archers could fire at you, you may as well get your shield up and run. And so the soldiers would have to know how to run. And not only did they have to run, sometimes they had to run while they were fighting and run with their armor. Just a little verse I thought was interesting. When David was running from King Saul, and he was living out in the wilderness, little by little soldiers were joining themselves to David, and he attracted some of the very best soldiers in the kingdom. It says in 1 Chronicles 12:8, some of the Gadites from the tribe of Gad joined David at the stronghold in the wilderness. Mighty men of valor trained for battle who were as swift as gazelles on the mountains. David had a nephew. I think it was Asahel was his name. Yeah, Asahel, brother of Adonijah. And it says he could run like a deer. You just couldn't catch him. That was the thing that where he went down in history. And then you can read in some of David's Psalms, just one example is Psalm 18:33. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer, and he sets me on high places. So if you want to run faster, pray that God will give you deep deer feet. Talking. You ever seen goats on the rocks, how agile they are? I remember when I lived up in the mountains, they had these bighorn sheep. That Southern California still has some bighorn sheep, and this was one of the places, and we used to see them. And I just couldn't believe it. They would be on cliffs that looked to me like sheer cliffs, like nothing would be able to stick to the side of that cliff. And these goats would run up. They'd find little ledges about that wide. Their feet were so secure. They could run up and down, and the little ones too. And it was just always amazing to me. No matter how young they were, they knew how to just keep their weight up against the cliff wall and run down these itsy-bitsy ledges. So sure-footed. The Bible says that God will give us those kind of feet. And that means it keeps you from slipping and falling when you're running. Shepherds know how to run. Habakkuk 3:19, the Lord God is my strength. He will make my feet like the deer's feet, and he'll make me walk on my high hills. Keep in mind, in the land of Israel, when they talked about deer, they're often talking about these more goat-like creatures. They don't have our white-tailed or black-tailed deer there. So it was a little different picture. Now, if you're going to win the race, racing is hard work. You know that, don't you? 2 Timothy 2:3, you therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. You want to win a race, it can be tough. It sometimes is a struggle. You got to learn how to work. You got to learn how to run. Luke 9:57, a man came to Jesus one time and said, Lord, I'm going to follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said, oh, really? It's easy to make a glib commitment like that. Jesus said, foxes have their holes and birds of their air have the nest, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Following Jesus was a rugged business. Be sleeping under the trees in the Garden of Gethsemane or out on a hillside somewhere. If you're following Jesus because you're watching prosperity preachers and you think that he's going to make you healthy, wealthy, and wise, that's not what Christ said. He said, I don't even have anywhere to lay my head. Listen to what Paul says. 2 Corinthians 11:23. About running that race, you got to be tough. Paul is comparing himself to some of the other counterfeit ministers, and he says, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. In labors, more abundant. In stripes, above measure, meaning I've lost count. In prisons, more frequently. In deaths, often. He'd actually been stoned to death. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. That's another way of saying 39 stripes, because you couldn't whip a person 40 times. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. By the way, stoning was a death sentence. So that would be like me saying, you know, once I was hung. You usually don't survive that. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. 1 night and 1 day I have been in the deep. In journeys, often in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the country, in perils in the sea. That sort of covers it, city, country, and ocean. In perils among the false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness, often in hunger and in thirst, in fastings, often in cold and nakedness. This is why Paul could say in 2 Timothy, I have fought a good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. He knew it was hard, but he saw the finish line. and he knew he was going to make it. Now, sometimes people aren't committed to the hard work. I don't know if any of you remember Shannon Faulkner. This was a young lady who applied to be a cadet at what was up until then an all-boy military school called the Citadel. Do any of you remember that? 93 in history. And she took him to court. It was a boys' military school. When I went to Black Fox Military and when I went to New York Military, they were just boys' military schools. Both of them, well, Black Fox is closed. New York is now a co-ed military school. And so she insisted that she wanted to be, and she took him to court. And she fought, I forget, it may have gone to the Supreme Court, but it went to one of the upper courts, and she won. And she was admitted to the military school. But at that time, they only had one exercise program, and they all used to have to go out and run. That was part of, any of you been in the military? Any people been in, don't be ashamed, heaven forbid. Did you run? Oh yeah, they run you. About 3 days after enrolling, she dropped out because she said she couldn't handle, that she wasn't prepared for the rigorous exercise program, and sort of slipped off the scene after that. Jeremiah 12:5 asks an interesting question. He says, if you've run with the footmen and they've wearied you, how will you contend with horses? If you think I'm going to run that race, and if you're running with the footmen, and they weren't necessarily the fastest runners because they had all the gear, if you can't keep up with the footmen, how are you going to contend or compete with horses? And being a Christian, who is it that is our example? It's Christ. And he said, I've given you an example that you should walk even as I have walked, and we should run as he ran. Now, there are stories of people, though, who have entered the race knowing how hard it would be and did not give up. Have you heard of Wilma Rudolph? Wilma Rudolph was one, she was the 20th of 22 children in her family. Born into a very poor family, she was only about 4.5 pounds when she was born. By the time she was 4 years old, she contracted double pneumonia and polio. And her legs became paralyzed, as they did back then, frequently. And she was badly crippled. Some of you remember this is what President Roosevelt struggled with. He could never really walk very well. He used a cane and a wheelchair later in life. And they said she'd never walk again. But her family had strong faith in God, and she continued to make every effort. Eventually, she talked them into getting her some leg braces. And you've probably seen the children that walked with these pretty cumbersome leg braces. And one day, she surprised the doctors, and she said, I want you to take off the braces now. And they took off the braces, and she was able to stumble along and kind of limpingly walk. Gradually, she continued to work at it. She didn't just walk where she needed to go. She would practice walking. And she continued to practice walking until she was able to walk by the time she was 13 without a noticeable limp. And so she wanted to be like other kids. And then after she realized she could walk, she started to just jog a little bit. She told her family, she says, I want to race. And they said, don't embarrass yourself. And she says, no, I want to race. And they couldn't discourage her. And so Wilma entered a race. And she, of course, lost. She was in last place. Matter of fact, she was in last place in every race she entered at first. And then eventually one day, she actually came in first in a race. And from the time that she came in first in a race, she then never came in second beyond that. She got so good at running, she ended up entering the Olympics, and she won 3 Olympic gold medals. And this was a girl who was born with polio, but she knew that life was hard. And she continued to work at it and work at it until she became an Olympic gold winner. She never gave up. If you're going to win a race, there are rules you have to follow. Even in the ancient Greek games, they had perimeters for the race. There's roads you needed to stay on. There was a starting time, and you needed to compete fairly. Well, there are rules in this race. 2 Timothy 2:5. Also, if anyone competes in athletics, he is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules. That's the New King James Version translation, but it's clear enough. There are rules in the race of life, And we know that the Ten Commandments are the guidebook. We need to run as God has outlined in His Word. I remember reading, poor guy, October 25, 1964, Minnesota Vikings defensive end Jim Marshall in a game against the San Francisco 49ers. The 49ers fumbled the ball. James, in the chaos, he grabbed the fumbled ball and he ran towards the end zone, held up his arms for a touchdown, and then discovered he had ran the wrong direction. Yes, it was the end zone, but instead of getting 6 points for his team, he won a safety for the enemy team. He said his first clue was when the opponents came up and hugged him. That's really sad, because otherwise he was a very good player. But in the chaos of the field, he got turned around, and even though he was absolutely sincere, he was running the wrong way. And they couldn't change the rules for him. The end zone was where the end zone is. We've got to run and follow those rules. Another key, I think, to winning a race is you've got to be running for something bigger than yourself. If you're only running to win a crown for yourself, you know, that is never the best motive. You want to run for a greater cause. Have you heard about the great race? Now, we're not talking right now about a running race, but it was an auto race. Back in 1908, February 12th, it's my mother's birthday. It's also Lincoln's birthday. 250,000 spectators gathered in New York City for the first and only international car race. There were six contestants in that race. That's an actual photograph, and there you see the six cars. The car that won, I'll tell you about in a moment, is the one on the bottom right corner. It was a car called the Thomas Flyer. They gathered there for this race. The newspapers were going to track them around the world as they took off on this race. Now, you realize this is shortly after cars were invented. This is an around-the-world auto race. The problem was they decided to have this first auto race to go around the world before they had roads going around the world, before they even had gasoline stations around the world. But they made up their mind to do it. And now, because all the different racers represented different countries, they felt like they couldn't quit because, I mean, you know, they were these major nations of the world that were competing against each other. And it was like America against Italy and England and Germany and France and these other countries. And something interesting happened, though. When the car, the American car, was called the Thomas Flyer, they're not even made anymore. I think it was a four-cylinder, 140 horsepower. Oh, it wasn't even that. I think it was maybe 60 horsepower. It was a four-cylinder, 60-horsepower car. They had no cabs. It's open cab. The headlights back then were like a kerosene lamp in the front of the boat. That's what it was. It was a boat. Front of the car. And they took off, and they decided, you know what time of year February is? They took off from New York City in winter to go to San Francisco. They thought that they were going to somehow drive. I'm not kidding. They took boats up. They ferried the cars up to Alaska, thinking that they were going to drive across the Bering Strait in wintertime. They got up there and found out that they couldn't get through the snow. It was too deep. The race official said, okay, you can go across the ocean to Russia on ferry, and you'll continue the race from Vostok, Russia. And so they ferried across to Russia. They had to go across Russia. You know, Russia covers 11 time zones. They had to go across Russia. There's no gas stations. They would do everything. They were bribing ship owners and people to try and get gas. Was still a fairly new commodity. They had to carry a lot of their own. They got stuck. They had to help each other out several times when they got stuck. It was just, it's an epic, amazing story. And I don't have time to tell you the whole thing. A lot of times they had to get on railroad tracks because there was no road. And they were driving down railroad tracks in these cars that had the old primitive tires where you had tubes, and they had no shock absorbers. Can you imagine driving 8 hours on railroad ties? No shock absorbers in the car. How many times they had to change the flats and patch the flats? Sometimes their tires were almost solid patches on the tubes. It was astounding. They'd get stuck in They had to hire dog teams at some points to pull them across Russia through the snow. And it was just an incredible, epic story of how they completed this race, went across the U.S., they went across Europe, ultimately finished in Paris. Out of the 6 cars that began, only 3 finished. Different points along the way, news reporters were flown in to take pictures and chronicle the race. The amazing thing is, the guy who won the race was the driver of the American car. The American car won the race. His name was George Schuster. George was not even scheduled to be part of the race. George showed up from the Thomas Flyer Car Company to deliver the car to the starting line, and the mechanic for the American team got cold feet and quit the day of the race. When George delivered the car, they said, "How'd you like to go on a race around the world?" He said, "Well, I'm not a mechanic, and I wasn't expecting this." They said, "Well, opportunity knocks." He changed his clothes, he hopped on board, and it turned out George, who didn't even plan on being in the race, was the only member of the American team to finish the race. He's the one who basically became the driver and won the race. And he lived to 99 years of age. It's just an amazing story sometime. But when he realized that his country was calling, and he thought, it would be a shame to drop out of this race. What's going to happen? I represent my whole nation. And so he thought, how can I say no? And so for him, the whole thing about winning the race was, it's not about me. It was about representing our people, our country. It was something bigger than himself that made him press on. It was a great race. Well, if you're going to run in a race, you want to run because you've got a bigger goal. Hebrews 12, verse 1 and 2. Have you read this? Therefore, since we're surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, when we look through the Bible at these great heroes, men and women of faith, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is before us. We want to run that race with endurance. Why? Because of the cloud of witnesses that we have set before us. Not be easily discouraged. And then you notice the another important thing in a race is you want to have the right goal in mind. It said, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he is set down for us as an example. And so we're to fix our eyes on Jesus and run that race. A lot of people in the world are involved in, everyone's involved in a race. The question is, are you just in the rat race? Some people are running after things they're never going to catch. I grew up in Florida, and they have these dog races there. You know the greyhounds? And they train them in the races to run after an electrical rabbit. And I never actually went to one of those races, but we drove by frequently some of the different arenas. And they have a mechanical rabbit that is really just this furry ball of rabbit skin that is wrapped around a decoy that is on a rail with an electric motor. And when the race starts, these dogs, they smell the rabbit, and this mechanical rabbit begins to take off, and they keep it just ahead of the dogs. The dogs are never supposed to catch the rabbit, but they're trained to run after a rabbit they're never going to catch. It reminds you of some people out there. And so they start the race, and the dogs go off yapping, and this thing goes screaming around the track, and the dogs are yapping after it. And I heard about a couple of interesting races. One time, they had not mowed the grass where the electric rail went by with the mechanical rabbit, and it rained the day before the race, and so the grass was wet. And so when the rabbit went by, it shorted out on the grass, and in the midst of this race, and all the fans are screaming, and the dogs are full bore barking after it, the bunny blew up. The rabbit exploded. And they talked about the consternation of the dogs that were all kind of these poor anorexic looking dogs. They're just wandering around in the middle of it. They don't know what to do. They have no goal anymore. But isn't that really the fate that's going to face most of the world? They're going to find out one day that the rabbit they're chasing, they're never going to catch, and it wasn't even real. Which is contrasted with another story I heard about the dog races. in the middle of one of those races someday, they have the track carefully fenced, but somehow a real rabbit managed to get underneath the fence. And in the midst of one of those races, this rabbit was calmly nibbling grass on the edge of the track, and nobody saw it. And the dogs started yapping, and the rabbit heard it, and the rabbit took off across the track. And the dogs looked very confused, because most of the dogs, they were so used to chasing the mechanical rabbit, they just kept on. They looked at this real rabbit go by, and they kept going after the mechanical rabbit. But one of the dogs stopped, and he looked at the mechanical rabbit, and he looked at the real one, and he decided to go after the real one. He bounded the fence, and he took off. I don't know if they ever did find him, but you feel good for him, don't you? Finally, go after the real thing. If you're going to win the race, you need to stay focused on the goal. Have you heard about Felix Carvel? This is another amazing story. During the Olympics of 1904, there was a mailman in Havana, Cuba, who did a lot of running, delivering the mail, delivering messages. And he got to be a pretty good runner. And when he heard that in America that they were going to have a race, Cuba had just sort of been independent, become an independent country, and they had no Olympic committee, they had no team. But he decided he was going to represent Cuba, and he would enter the marathon. And he went around town, had to raise his own money. He would run circles around the courtyard and carried on and told everybody he was going to win the race for the country, and he was able to raise. He got a purse of money so that he could travel to America, and he really had enough to get him to the race and to enter the race. But when he took off and he came to America, Felix was just a very energetic man, but he was easily distracted. And on one of the ships going up the Mississippi heading to St. Louis, he started gambling, started playing dice. He used up his money for part of the passage, and he realized he was going to miss the race. He got dropped off somewhere not far out of New Orleans, and he had to walk or run or hitchhike all the way up to St. Louis. Didn't get to eat very much. When he got to the race competition, the actual race was minutes from beginning. He showed up, and they said, "Where'd you come from?" He said, "I just walked from New Orleans. I ran part of the way." He had actually spent all night running because he didn't know how to go back home and tell them that he'd gambled away the money, and he actually tried the story for a while. I was robbed. They later found out what happened. But when he got to the race, he showed up, and they said, "Well, the race is getting ready to start." And he said, "Well, I've come from Cuba to enter the race." 95 pounds, 5 feet 1 inches tall. But he was an incredible runner. But he was more like the hare than the tortoise, if you know what I mean. On American, they postponed the race for a minute. All he had on was wool knickers and this pirate-like blouse and a beret. And one of the American runners found a knife, and they cut off his knickers and fashioned, it was 100 degrees. Cut off his running shorts and fashioned some running pants. Starting gun went off. They took off running, and they were astonished. This little bitty Cuban mailman was able to keep up with the best runners from around the world to enter the race. He was keeping up with them without even trying. But he was such a social guy, he was easily distracted. He was waving to the cameras. He was so happy to be here. This had been his dream. He heard some people along the way speak in Spanish, and he stopped to talk to them. He thought, "I'll have no problem catching up with these guys." And he was really fast. I mean, he was like a rocket. And he even would talk to people running backwards. He was talking to the other runners. He was running backwards talking to them. And he just kind of won the whole crowd over. They thought he was so much fun. Well, along the way, he hadn't eaten the whole day before the race. He saw along the way was a tree, but the apples were still green. And he stopped and he munched down a couple of those green apples, which gave him incredible intestinal problems, which created another delay. In spite of all that, he resumed the race. He came in fourth out of the world field. Felix's problem was he couldn't stay focused. If he had kept focused on the goal, he probably would have won the race. Well, we're involved in a race of life. And, you know, without God's help, we're not going to be able to win. I remember another incredible runner that we find in the Bible, and it's the prophet Elijah. You know, the Bible tells us that Elijah, and if you go to 1 Kings 18:44, Elijah was able to do some supernatural running. Of course, he had lived out in the wilderness for years, and he probably knew something about it. But if you go to 1 Kings 18, when the rain came, it says, "It came to pass the seventh time after he prayed for rain, he told King Ahab, he said, 'Prepare your chariot and go down before the rain stops you.' And it happened in the meantime that the sky became black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy rain. So Ahab rode away and went to Jezreel, and the hand of the Lord came upon Elijah." Now, Ahab's in a chariot. Didn't we just read that? "The hand of the Lord came upon Elijah. He girded up his loins," and that's another way of saying, they used to wear robes when you were going to run. You used to tie it up and tuck it in and put a belt on it so you could be free without unencumbered clothing tripping you up. "He girded up his loins, and he ran ahead of Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel." You know, it says, if you can't keep up with a footman, how will you contend with horses? Elijah could contend with horses. He was some runner. And one more story, 1 Kings 19, next chapter. Now he's running in the wilderness for his life, and it says he slept under a broom tree. Suddenly an angel touched him and said, "Arise and eat." He had been out running for his life, and he rose and he ate and drank, and he laid down again. And the angel of the Lord came back a second time, and he touched him, and he said, "Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you." He was on his way to Mount Sinai, way down in the wilderness. So he arose, and he ate and drank. And he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. Well, that's farther than Cliff Young. Can you imagine doing a marathon for 40 days and 40 nights on one meal? Now, how are we going to win that race to the mountain of God? You got to eat God's food. You know, some of these runners take steroids. I wonder what would happen if we ate that manna that the angel gave Elijah. Or maybe we can. If we're going to have the strength to run that race, we need to be eating God's bread, right? And drinking his water. You know, like Paul says, "I fought a good fight. I finished my course." I want to say that at the end of my life, right? You can't get discouraged if you trip along the way. You've got to get up and keep on going and keep running that race. We've got to run the race because we have a message. We have to run the race because it's about something bigger than us. Angels are watching. We're surrounded by this crowd, a cloud of witnesses, I should say, that are watching. It's about a big message. And it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. You ever seen some of those pictures when the runner comes across the race, and especially when it's close, they're taught to stretch out their arms and they thrust their chest forward so they can break the ribbon. You ever seen that? You know what I'm talking about? That's what Jesus did when he won that race for you and I. He spread out his arms and he said, "It is finished." And because he was victorious in running that race, then we can be victorious. You know, it seems like every marathon record that has been set has been broken. Some of you remember, and maybe you don't remember, no, nothing personal. They wondered if anyone was going to beat the 3-minute mile. Well, that's long since been in the history books, right? And now every time they keep trying to go a little farther. You know what encourages those champion runners? They say, "Someone else did it. That means it's humanly possible to do it. And if they did it, if I just work harder and discipline myself, I can do it." So if you're trying to break the record and you're following someone that did the 15-minute mile, well, that's as far as you're going to get. I can do a 15-minute mile. You can do a 15-minute mile. You can probably walk it. But if I'm going to follow someone that, if I want to win a race where someone did a 3-minute mile, that's a whole different level. If you're a Christian, don't pick the lowest denominator and look around you, compare yourselves among yourselves and by yourselves. If you're a Christian, who is the runner that's pacing for us? Jesus is out before us, and we want to keep him before us. You know, a lot of times in these races, it helps. There'll be a pacer. The champion stays behind, the one who's going to end up breaking the ribbon, and part of his team will stay right behind him. They do this especially in the cycling races. And he will help break the airway before him so that it's a little easier for him. He'll set the pace for him. And when they get around the last stretch, he falls back so that the other can cross over. Well, Jesus has spent his life, he came to this world to set the pace for us, to show us that we can be victorious. But he did it so that we can win that race. But the Bible tells us if we're going to win that race, we've got to keep our eyes fixed upon the goal. Amen? And Jesus is our example. He is our goal. I want to win that race, friends. And I trust that you do too. And we're going to sing about it now. So why don't you stand? I want to have a prayer with you and just ask that God will give us the courage to keep on running. Pray for me in case I ever do get around to entering a marathon.